take 10, side 2, 3-11, 1977.
Go ahead. Well, the only point being you'd have no objection to if this bill is going to move to strike that language, would you? It would be redundant, I would think.
I certainly would not, know. It's virtually meaningless, really, in the city.
This question can wait. I had a little problem with the to the extent necessary to prevent curtailment of opportunities for youth employment being in the statute. I'm not sure that that has is appropriate.
I agree. Let me hand it first. To follow up on Representative Willem's question, supposing the unlikelihood that the minimum wage would be somehow lowered, then the $1.95 would be triggered.
Well, that thought just never went down on the end of the
star. Okay. What we're talking about is, in your case, you don't hire anybody under 16 years of age.
Same thing, I hire 15-year-olds. I have one working for me right now.
Okay, so generally speaking, that as this bill would affect you, it would be the persons that are either 16 or 17 years old, generally speaking.
Yes, yeah.
All right. And we're talking about a 120-day period that it would only be for anyway, and Representative Willems brought up the question of changing the staff at that time in order to stay in the 85%, and you said that it would be foolish for a restaurant to do this because
my
sense is centigrade. Then you said the turnover list is quite high, and I wondered how long a period a person works. I'm presuming the turnover list, we want to keep the trained employee, so probably the employee quits rather than is dismissed for some reason.
Well, ordinarily, sometimes we get them, they work 2 days and you don't see them again, or they decide they don't like it. This is where most of our turnover is for short periods of time. Either that or they've been with me 2 years and they leave.
Then it's likely that if they survived the 120 days, they liked what they were doing. Or didn't find something I liked better, that then they wouldn't likely to be in this massive turnover.
Yeah.
They would stay a while.
In my situation, if they stayed with me 120 days, I'd want to keep them. If they left, it would be a drain.
Yeah. Okay, thanks.
Mm-hmm.
Any further questions?
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
It's about time to go up to the floor. These two bills are going to be set for another hearing. Before I forget that, I want to go back just briefly to a position with House Bill 2676, the employment relations board. There was one amendment that I did not speak about with the board, and I would like it understood by the committee that's incorporated into the bill. And that amendment appeared on line 23 of page 2 when it was talking about the selection of the chairman. And the language under the old growth version said the board shall select one of its members chairman was deleted. It's understood that that is to be added back in to the language of the bill.
No. Okay.
The board shall elect one of its members chairman.
Mm-hmm. That, is
that will be added back
that
in.
Will be back in. Okay.
A question here.
Okay, Gary.
Yeah.
Okay, okay. Go ahead. Mr. Walden. What's most convenient for you? No, for everybody's interest, that Mr. Murray Rubin from the Employment Division will be here Monday, from the federal government. He's going to go over any questions you have on the recent statutory enactments by Congress as it relates to the unemployment compensation law. I've decided to open up the hearing to people like yourself, Paul, that if you have a concern about some particular change that's been told that it's being mandated by the federal government as to why it's coming about and whether the state is mandated to adopt the particular provision proposed by the Employment Division. Representative Walden, I will assure you that at this particular time you need not worry about this particular bill. And I will give you an opportunity to come in and talk about it at your pleasure. Either personally or before the book committee. Thank you very much. The meeting's adjourned.
Cut to your table.
Council of the Committee, Monday, March 14th, work session. HB 2131 through 2134 with Mary Rubin. Page 10, side 2.
Joint Legislative Calendar that was published today has a Friday work session scheduled at 1:30 p.m. Those of you who know me know that there's no way that I would put a work session for 1:30 on Friday. That is an error, and we will contact the printing people and tell them that that's at 8:30. So if you got the calendar that says 1:30, it's at 8:30. Thank you, Carl.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Roger.
Before we go too far here from all the propaganda I've been hearing this weekend, I presume that the former mayor from Greater Downtown Troutdale is going to have a smelt fry for the members of this committee.
At his home?
Yes.
Well, may I respond, Mr. Chairman?
Yes, go right ahead, sir.
The members of this committee are invited to drive to Greater Troutdale and distance of 66 miles, all freeways, and I will furnish the nets and liquid refreshments. You people would care to come up and get your own. You pick, huh? And you pick, right, you pick, huh?
I don't pick, but I'll come up for those refreshments.
And I might add, Mr. Chairman, that yesterday people were, and I'm not exaggerating when I say they were standing 4 feet apart on the banks of the Sandy River, and people were lined up behind them waiting for someone to move out so they could move in.
Oh, but I know what that is, Glenn. That's your anti-nudity bill.
Yeah, it's the
truth. That's why they're up
there. And we did have 2 heart attacks on the river yesterday and 2 deaths. From different snow.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately.
We're going to depart from the usual format for today's committee hearing, and the reason is that we have a guest with us, and I'm somewhat pleased that he came all the way out here, Mr. Mary Rubin from the U.S. Bureau of Labor. And what I would like to do, Mr. Rubin, if I could just introduce you to the committee's members, because I'm not going to keep it in that formalized of a structure. And the purpose of the meeting was that we have been hearing what Congress did this last October to the unemployment compensation system. Some of the committee members have a concern, I think, about what the intent of some of those amendments were, and they're also concerned, as all the states are, about why the federal government passes enactments and asks us to comply with them without giving us the financial assistance to undertake some of the changes. But if you would want to come up to the council table, to the witness table here, and I'll introduce you to the people so that we can get more on an informal basis. I'll start out on my far right is Representative Al Riebel, who is from Marion County here where the capital is,
yes,
in Salem. This is Representative Bill Rogers from Vida, who is in Eastern Lane County. Representative Ed Lindquist isn't here. This is our legal counsel, Anita Paulson. I think she's the one that's been talking to you back east.
Yes.
My name is Ted Kolingowski, and I represent the other half of the county that Representative Rogers is from. This is Representative George Starr from Portland, Representative Glenn Otto from Troutdale, which is up by, Portland is a suburb of Troutdale. And Representative Gary Wilson from Klamath Falls.
How do you do?
The notice that went out is that two of the major areas that the people are concerned about is in education and agriculture labor. And what I've asked is the people from the farm community and the agriculture community and the different groups that if they felt that they would like to ask you a question about a particular measure or an idea, that they could do that.
Of course.
And if you'd have any, I guess you're not going to have any questions about whether we're going to do it that way or not. But we'd like to get you in a position like that so it would be rather open so that some of the people will understand why the state has taken the action to finally try to get some of the concerns that Congress had when they uncovered some people in the legislation. So I would like to open it up to the questions and for me, the community members first, if they would like to start. Representative Wilhelm.
Well, there seems to be a lot of confusion over...
Would you like to buy a cup of coffee? No, thank you. I just had some breakfast.
In particular, over House Bill 2131, I believe, was the bill that, that we had most of the questions over, that dealt with the changes in the unemployment laws pertaining to classified, unclassified schools, public school employees, and employees in institutions of higher education also, as to whether or not, well, I'll give you a specific, and then maybe we can, I'm sure that we'll probably end up expanding on it. We seem to always do this as we get into it, but the question is, to between successive terms or non-successive terms and the eligibility of employees, both classified and professional, to draw unemployment compensation benefits during that period of time, when they can't, what conditions have to exist in order for them to do so, and the whole of Marianne, really. Could you just spend some time talking about that?
Sure, I'd be happy to. This is probably one of the most disputed or controversial provisions in the legislation itself. And it goes back, as I'm sure you know, to really, it has its origin in the 1970 amendment, Public Law 91373, where for the first time Congress extended coverage on a mandatory basis to employees of state institutions of higher education, colleges and universities. I think, I'm guessing, but I think as a kind of quid pro quo for the extension of coverage to workers in those institutions, Congress accepted for the first time a special treatment with respect to certain categories of those employees, namely professors. Those people in an instructional, research, or principal administrative capacity, for the first time in the unemployment, in the history of the unemployment insurance program, it carved out for special treatment certain categories of employee. And it said that, first, all the terms and conditions of the state law that apply to regular claimants who are drawing benefits on the basis of private employment must apply also to this newly covered group, namely professors and researchers and employees of colleges and universities, with one exception, and that is that during the period between academic years or between two academic successive academic years or between two regular but not successive terms, then they shall be denied benefits if they have a contract, one for the first of such term or year and also a contract for the second term or year. And we've had that situation now since 1970 that became effective for state purposes in beginning, I think, 1972. Now, that the same thinking carried over into the temporary program that was enacted in late 1974, in December 74, the SUA program, Special Unemployment Assistance. This was aimed at providing temporary protection for the people who are not included in regular unemployment insurance program. And this, of course, brought into the umbrella of this special program high school teachers and grammar school teachers. And the same between-term denial provision was embedded also in this SUA law, which incidentally has been extended by reason of the 1976 amendment through June of 1978. And finally, the current legislation that every state, including Oregon, is now involved in implementing carried it a step further. When the current legislation extended coverage, unemployment insurance coverage, practically across the board to most employees, with very few exceptions of state and local government, it continued this between terms provision with two distinctions. First of all, the states are required as a condition for tax offset credit to extend coverage to professional employees. Again, the same three categories of employees, those in the teachers, researchers, and principal administrators. They're required also to deny benefits between terms. So far as professionals are concerned, now if they have a contract or a reasonable assurance to perform the same services in both terms. The states are given also, by reason of this last legislation, the option of extending the between-terms denial to non-professional employees who are mandatorily covered. In other words, they can require that cafeteria workers in high schools or school bus drivers employed by high schools or grammar schools may be denied benefits between terms, but if they do that, then they would deny them on the basis of whether or not that they had a contract for both terms, but rather that they had a reasonable assurance of re-employment the second term. Now, that's a long, involved answer, and I'm sure it doesn't hit directly to precisely what you're getting at. But
I wish you could have been on some of our previous discussions. You know, that's pretty short answer compared to some of the ones we've gotten into. But I would like to expand on it a little bit.
Go right ahead.
The denial that you're talking about, we would have the ability to write into the Oregon law, would be between academic years,
yes,
between regular but not successive terms.
It would apply, as we're interpreting it, between terms, whether or not successive.
Terms, whether or not successive.
Yes, sir.
Then, to make this about as silly as it made it seem, we would be able to draft the legislation in Oregon so that in all cases, we could deny benefits to an employee, either professional or either classified or unclassified, between regular successive terms.
Yes, sir.
That's
assuming that they have, in the case of professionals, either a contract or a reasonable assurance, and in the case of non-professionals, reasonable assurance of coming back the next term.
Okay. Not sure. maybe you could give us some examples of what might constitute reasonable assurance.
Take a teacher, a high school teacher, for example, who come the end of June is, let's assume that he or she does not have a contract, but there are two things that must take place in order for the denial to apply. And if the teacher does not have a contract, I suppose most teachers probably do, but in case they don't, then a reasonable assurance would apply. First, the school board or whomever the employing unit is has to notify the individual that they will be rehired the following term. And then the employment agency, the agency responsible for handling unemployment insurance, would, when the individual comes in and files a claim, seek from the school board confirmation that the school board has notified the teacher that the teacher has reasonable assurance. And the school board will provide that to the agency in writing. So that just provide protection to the teacher. If I might, I would like to elaborate a little bit on how that came to pass, that phrase, a reasonable assurance, because I remember being at the discussion before the Subcommittee on Unemployment Compensation, the House Ways and Means Committee, when it did take place.
Feel free to use whatever format most comfortable.
There was some feeling that if the provision, the required denial, were limited to contracts, that teachers would take the route of refusing to sign a contract until the very last minute, say, come September, and thereby become eligible for unemployment compensation. Aside from whether or not that's realistic, I think that was some reason for bringing in this other possibility of a reasonable assurance. The trouble then was that the feeling on the part of others was that if all that was needed to deny a teacher between terms was a reasonable assurance, then certainly all the school boards in the country would quickly grant the same effect that all teachers or all employees would have a reasonable assurance of coming back. So to offset that, the committee in its conference report between the Senate and the House spelled out a little bit what they meant by reasonable assurance, and it went pretty much along the same lines that I described. Senator Gravitz before then had introduced a proposal saying that if come September the reasonable assurance falls through and the individual is not actually rehired, the state would be liable, or the employer would be liable for a retroactive payment covering the summertime. This did not prevail because I think of the fear that some teachers, after having gotten reasonable assurance in June, would just take off on vacation. Then you'd have the spectacle of a retroactive payment for the summer months for someone who really had not, during that time, been in the labor market. That was pretty much the background, and it came to, a reasonable assurance came to mean, and it's spelled out in the conference report, that the teacher must be given a reasonable assurance. But the reasonable assurance has to have some basis in fact. It must be the best judgment of the school board at that time. It has to be, in other words, a bona fide assurance. If it's not, it can be challenged by the teacher. And the challenge would be subject to the same appeal procedures that now prevail with respect to anybody in unemployment insurance that's denied benefits. That's a long-winded answer. I'm sorry.
That's good experience. I think it does go along with what we've heard before, too. One of the areas of real confusion seemed to be in the community college area where sometimes you don't recruit an instructor because there's no need until you have the students for the class, and sometimes that doesn't happen until right at the beginning of the term that we're talking about. And this could be either between successive terms, or it could be between the spring term and the fall term, or whatever the case might be. And as I recall, there was quite a considerable discussion over you know, how this law would apply to them. And even in the case of, specifically in the case of a person who is teaching classes at community colleges or a community college as a sideline. Maybe they didn't particularly want to work full time, but they had a skill at and the arrangement with the community college whereby they could go teach a class. And so this person might teach fall term and then lay out over the, they could lay out a whole term or maybe just even over the Christmas break, for example, and be actually, at the end of the term, they have no assurance of reemployment and does not work under a contract, but possibly then would be picked up at either winter term or spring term to teach a class again. And we were wondering how this law would apply to an individual in that situation, and especially to an individual in that situation who was not doing it for his livelihood, but was rather doing it just as a kind of a sideline.
Mm-hmm. Assuming that a teacher does this on a part-time basis and his normal occupation is something else, this is very common, particularly with respect to the community colleges. Remember that the statute provides that benefits based on services performed in an instructional research or principal administrative capacity may be denied, or must be denied during the summertime. So that if he's unemployed from both jobs in the summertime, this is just one hypothetical example, if he's unemployed from both jobs, he would be denied benefits only on the basis that only that part of his benefits that were based on his employment with the school. If he had been employed outside of that, say as a salesman, then the benefits based on his work as a salesman would still be payable to him.
Let me interject one thing. We're really talking more of a sideline. I misled you probably a little bit. We're talking about the person that could be semi-retired or maybe was not living in the household regularly because the spouse was bringing in the income. In the case, typical case of a housewife or something who wanted to stay home but didn't mind teaching the term here and there. I think we were talking about those situations more than we were the person who was working actually two jobs, working in one profession and then teaching as a sideline.
This is just a part-time job, and that was the only job of the individual. If he would be treated the same way as a full-time employee of the school, that's assuming that during his career at the school, during the time he worked for the school, he had earned enough wages and had been employed long enough to meet the basic qualifying requirements. And all of these things, too, I should add, although an individual without a reasonable assurance, a teacher, or a teacher without a contract, cannot be denied benefits on the basis of this special provision we've been talking about, that doesn't mean it automatically follows that the teacher will be paid benefits between terms, because the teacher or the school employee must, like every other claimant, need to be able to work, availability for work, and the other eligibility conditions of the state law. So it's not an automatic thing. even if they may not have a reasonable assurance or a contract, that they would be eligible for benefits during the summertime. I don't know if that responds enough to the question concerning the part-timer.
Yeah, well, it does. Just one more, Mr. Chairman, and I'll quit. We have a 2-week break between some terms, and of course, if all the schools are out during that period of time, there would be no ability for the person to go get the employment, and so we were hung up for quite a long time in discussion here over whether or not these people could, in fact, draw the benefits during the second week of that break between successive terms. Now, from what you told me earlier, they could be denied.
Yes,
because they would have reasonable assurance of going back, unless it was the case of this person who wasn't actually recruited until right at the time the term began because of the need for a teacher for the class. But in the case of a 2-week break, we do have the ability, without being in non-compliance with the federal law, to write into the statute, or write the statute in such a way, anyway, that in all cases these people could be denied if they did have a reasonable assurance of teaching the next successive term.
Yes, sir, but may I make a distinction? The required denial applies to the period either between academic years or the period between two terms. If a Christmas break falls within a term, within a single term, in some cases schools don't break during that period. It's not a regular term. Then this required between terms denial does not apply. So if a teacher met all the eligibility conditions during the Christmas break or a recess period that did not fall between terms, this requirement would not apply to them. It only applies between two terms or two academic years, during the break between those times. If the Christmas break is, in fact, as is the case, I guess, in most cases, between two regular terms, then the denial would apply.
Well, the school across the street does not break for Christmas between terms. They have 2 semesters a year, and they have a Christmas break sometime during the first semester. I don't know just when it is. But
so the Christmas break falls within a term.
Within a term.
Then this would not apply.
This, by not applying, you mean that they would not even be considered in any way for unemployment compensation?
No, sir, the opposite. If by saying this would not apply, it would mean that the state would be required to treat these people during the Christmas break that fell within a term on the same basis that it treats other people who are laid off for Christmas time.
Well, but it wouldn't apply if they were under contract.
The contractual obligations, well, it depends. If the law requires denial to other people, regular professionals in other occupations or who have a contract for both ends of the Christmas period. If it pays, for example, vacation pay for the Christmas period, and accordingly denies benefits during that period ordinarily, then the same approach is followed, should be followed with respect to school employees.
But okay, but if they're on an hourly basis, then, let's say if they're not professional people, if they're unclassified people, or if they're classified people, excuse me, and if they're on an hourly basis working in the kitchen, in the dormitory, knowing full well that they're going to go back to work after the Christmas break is over, and if the Christmas break does last 2 weeks, then they could draw a week of unemployment compensation.
It would depend on how the state law applies in that kind of a situation, not only for this category of worker, but also for his counterpart in other industries. If it would be denied, then the same thing should apply here.
Okay.
Now, they may well be denied. Most states, I'm not that familiar precisely with the Oregon law, but most states provide that during vacations, particularly during paid vacations, people are denied benefits. Also, many states may determine that an individual unemployed during the Christmas break with a regular return date may not be considered available for work, meet that kind of a condition. But the application depends upon the particular state law.
I guess our major question here is, is there a problem with compliance with the federal law if we were to write our law in the state of Oregon so that we could, in all cases, deny benefits in that situation?
I believe they would, sir.
They would be in compliance?
I think there would be a problem.
There would be a problem.
Yes,
okay,
sir.
That's what we wanted to find out. I think that's enough for now, Mr. Chairman.
Lieutenant Rogers, why would there be a problem?
It would be a problem because in addition to the required denial under precise conditions between terms of school employees, that whole section is prefaced by a requirement that these people, along with other newly covered groups, must be treated on the same terms and conditions under the same circumstances, must benefits be paid, and so forth, to these people as applies to other people covered under the state law. This is kind of required equal treatment would apply, with the single exception of the between terms. I wish it weren't so darn complicated, and my own feeling is I wish Congress had not seen fit to carve out for special treatment the category. It's caused a great number of problems, and
I think, Mark, what happened for them was that Oregon in 73, that's, I guess, it was ahead of the federal government because we brought the public.
Oregon is certainly ahead of the federal government.
And what happened is that we thought we had the problem fairly well resolved here through a couple of court cases, and how they handled the situation that Representative Wilhelms was talking to you about is they caught the teachers on the guaranteed wage provision of the statute and eliminated them on that. But then this comes along, and as you said, it's extremely confusing, and it seems to be that what we had established in this state is some sort of a format on how we're going to treat these people. It seems the federal government is coming in telling us that we have to change that. And I think that's what Bill is talking about, really concerned about right now.
So you say we have to treat them the same as everyone else.
If we make sure
that our law excludes anyone who is going to return to work under this type of a situation, then that would be all right.
I think it would not create a conformity to the federal law, but I would urge careful consideration of that approach. As you know, states now pay benefits to people who are laid off on a temporary basis. I guess the classic example is the auto workers, mostly in Michigan, doing model changeovers. It's a regularly recurring period of unemployment, and temporary. These people are paid, and that's true with respect to a number of other categories and contingencies as the people are laid off, but for a temporary period. It is the intent of the program was to tide people over between periods of unemployment. And I suspect that many states feel like a surprise, even though an individual may have a full confidence of regaining his job after a week or two or three or a month or more.
So this is a problem now that's created for us in our local government units in particular, where the people are hired knowing what the schedule is going to be. They're going to be off during these periods of time, not necessarily between terms, and Christmas vacation or spring vacation could be an example of the type thing. And yet, then the law gets changed around so that as a windfall, the people can now draw unemployment compensation during the time that they had really expected to just be out of work, period.
Well, I submit that it doesn't necessarily follow that because the required denial between terms does not apply to periods within a term.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't necessarily follow that they would be eligible for benefits during that period. It depends on the other conditions of the state law, whether they were available for a work during that period, whether they were able to work, whether they refused a job, a suitable job, and the other conditions.
We have a problem there. What constitutes a suitable job for someone who's only going to be available for a week or two? What employer is going to hire someone under that condition? So it almost automatically excludes that person from the job market.
That's true.
And in that respect, if he wants to draw the
employment. If the individual is paid for that period, in effect, it's a paid vacation period, I think then the definition of the term of unemployment in the statute might apply.
which I think in Oregon, like most states, provides that an individual is unemployed only if he performs no services and earns no remuneration. If he's paid during Christmas time, he's constructively considered to have worked during that time in many states. Whether that would be characteristic of Oregon or not, I don't know.
Is there some way that we can, in our statutes, avoid paying unemployment compensation to these people who, by just about everyone's definition, are really not entitled to it?
I think that you can, certainly, but all I'm suggesting is that what you apply to school employees must also apply across the board to others in similar circumstances. The people that work in the department stores during Christmas time must be subject to the same limitations that you decide to impose if you do on school employees. And that's by reason of this so-called equal treatment requirement.
Stephen, I have a series of questions here I'd like to ask you just briefly and begin with. It's one, that you talked about the amendment that Senator Javits proposed for retroactive benefits, which was defeated.
Yes, sir.
I'm somewhat concerned about that because I'm assuming from your explanation of that if in June when a school closes, a school board intended that they would not have a position for a particular teacher available in the fall, the school board could say, yes, there's going to be a job. And let's say that at that time is given as a bona fide reasonable assurance. And then in September, well, let me go back. In June, that effectively cuts that teacher off. And then in September, when the teacher shows up, the school board says, sorry, that's the way it goes. And soon the teacher appeals it, and soon that the employment division finds that was not a bona fide reasonable assurance, there's still no retroactive benefit paid.
Yes, there is.
In that case, there will be.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. It was not a bona fide reasonable assurance. In that case, the individual would be eligible.
Okay.
The trust was to ensure that the school board would not play games with the teacher.
Okay, that's what I want to understand. Okay, I understand.
But for this individual to qualify, he will have had to have shown up every week or every 2 weeks, whatever the requirement is. He can't just go and stay home during that period of time, can he, and qualify because he was not actively seeking work.
Let's assume that I think in most cases that if he's going to challenge the school board, the bona fide nature of the offer or the contention that he has a reasonable chance, it's likely he'll challenge it during June, because that's when he'll be framing his claim.
Mm-hmm.
And the agency will tell him that as long as his case is pending, he should protect himself by filing and reporting and adhering to the requirements that each unemployed claimant must in order to be eligible.
If they did not tell him this, and if he did not check in weekly or biweekly, could he then be denied because he didn't meet all the requirements?
I think there would have to be, in that kind of a situation, a finding by the agency as to whether or not during that period the individual was in fact able to work and available for work.
And would have been doing that if in fact he had not been misled that he had a job in September?
That's a hard question. I don't know the answer. Let's assume, I don't think this would happen very frequently, but he was led to believe that the reasonable assurance was bona fide, and he didn't see fit to challenge it until September. The question then is, on what basis could he be paid retroactively?
Suppose that,
having gotten a reasonable assurance, that he lost the thing. I think we have a real problem. I think that he would certainly not have been available for work during that period, and yet there would be an equity problem. I guess I don't know the answer.
It's because I imagine the claimant's answer to that would have been that I would have never gone to Spain. Because you would have told me that I wasn't going to have a job in September, because I spent my next year's salary to go to Spain.
Yes, sir. Mr. Chairman, I guess the answer would be repay him. We'd recommend that he repay him.
The questions that we've had before the committee, and some of these came out of the situation here in Oregon, I don't think that any of us are proud of, but as you know back from the news reports that we had a situation out here where school districts were actually closing down because of failure to fund budget letters. We have a system here in Oregon with tenured versus probationary teachers. And the tenured teachers are never on contract in the sense that, they have a continuing contract. It's generally no written agreement, but once they've taught for 3 years and been recommended by the school board for employment in the fourth year, they're tenured. And the situation arose that we became concerned about was that down in Cottage Grove, which Representative Rogers represents, that the school started for the September and October. And approximately, as a rough figure, about the 1st of November, it closed because it ran out of funds. And they had a budget election in January, which they did pass. But we were faced with the possibility that budget levy would fail. Now, under our law, the way we have it set up, July 1 is the beginning of the fiscal year. And the school board, the tenured teachers, all would have had reasonable assurance that they would have had a job next September, the following September. And the school district could have opened because on our system of funding basic school, partly out of the state general fund, that they could have opened again. And there would have been a job available in September. Now, how long that job would have lasted is just unknown, because if they hadn't got another budget levy after July 1, I don't know if they would have made it. But we even have a provision. We have a series of elections in this state that they can have an election in November for the current operating school levy. But the question came up on the proposed federal statutory changes was that if these teachers were employed and had reasonable insurance that they would have been employed the next year, would they have been disqualified under this statute?
No, my guess, and not knowing what the actual details, my guess would be no, they would not be disqualified because they would, if I understand what you were saying, they were given a bona fide assurance of reemployment the following September. It was based on the facts available to the school board at that time. It was on the best understanding and expectations. I think it was a bona fide reemployment offer. The fact that it fell through was due to subsequent situation, subsequent conditions that they were not perhaps foreseen.
Okay, I think I've somewhat confused it. The problem is, assume this is the school year this year, 76 this last year, and the teacher started for the first 2 months, was unemployed the 1st of November. They have reassurance that they're going to be employed in September 1977. And this is getting into this between two regular but not successive terms.
Yeah, if they're unemployed, other than between two regular terms, other than regular terms, then they would be eligible if they meet all the other conditions.
What if the school district would have closed down at the end of the term?
If it had closed down?
Yeah, let's say it's on a semester basis.
Then they would be eligible following that closing down.
Even though they have a reasonable assurance.
Then after the term or between terms.
Okay. The two terms run.
You're a liar. I have to apologize for that.
The term runs between September and January and January and June. The term ends in June, January. The school district closes down for the spring term because of the lack of funds. But all of the tenured teachers have a reasonable assurance that they're going to be employed the following September.
This is really a between two regular terms, huh? If that's the case, then it would be denied.
Okay.
You know,
that's
scary, because we've got on the one hand a situation where people who have no valid claim at all for unemployment compensation could draw, and then people who really have every reason in the world that could be denied. And that really does concern me, and I can't believe that the Congress would intend to enact something like that into law. Because it's a very, without budgeting, free budgeting procedures, it's a very definite possibility that it could be stretched to the end of a term this way, and then the people would be off work from January to September. And I just find it very difficult to accept that those people would be denied benefits.
Well, here's the situation. They start in September 76 and they go to school. They can see. But because of a budget failure, in January, this spring semester is no school. But under our law, because they're senior teachers, they all have a reasonable assurance that they're going to be employed in September of 77. And this is the period that we're concerned about, between January and June of 1977, will those teachers be eligible for unemployment benefits?
My understanding would be they would be not, because this would be a period between two regular terms.
No, that's the way we interpret it.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like it's a great injustice, because the people are out of work through no fault of their own, and they're going to be unemployed for at least 8 months of that year. And I think you're well aware as I am of the problems with teachers getting jobs. I don't know what they're going to do. I'm looking at it from the school district perspective, but I think it's going to put the school district under a tremendous strain to have the teachers even return. And I can't believe it. And that's the thing, one of the issues we've been fighting in this bill since it first came up, 2131, is trying to know if we can cover that period between January and June for unemployment for those people. And you're saying that under the statute that's presently written, they would not be eligible.
That's my understanding.
Now, as I understand it, the federal law would not require that we not pay them.
Yes, sir, it would.
It would? Yes, sir. Even if we wanted to, we couldn't.
Right.
You mean there is something in the federal law that restricts the outflow of funds? Maybe that's a strategic question. That's the first time I ever heard that.
Representative Wilhelm, we've been talking about the required denial between terms. This is a required denial between terms.
But it is required. That's my point. It is required. We don't have the option. If we wanted to expand and be more generous with our benefits, we would not have the ability to do that.
No, the required denial means just that benefits may not be paid. The state is prohibited from paying benefits. This is not the only contingency where states, by reason of the amendments to 94-566, is prohibited from paying benefits. As you recall, it's prohibited from paying benefits to a certain aliens. It's prohibited from paying benefits to a certain professional athletes. There are other categories also. Your benefits must be denied. This is not unique or confined to this category.
Going ahead quick, but I want to ask you one more on that subject, because I have a couple more questions I'm going to come. Could we in fact define the phrase regular in our statute? Because, I mean, it says too regular, it seems to me that is not a regular term in the sense that we're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Could we in fact pass something that said that to the extent that benefits are often denied individuals who are unemployed for any period as a result of budget failures, of school budget failures, and defining that as irregular rather than regular?
The language of the statute, as you know, applies to regular between two regular academic years. And I think the implication of that was that this was a regularly recurring thing. This is a traditional historic pattern of school terms. If the session were delayed, say, from September to October, this would not be, for example, a regular term. This kind of adjustment for different reasons would not be considered a part of a regular term. I think there's some leeway there. Precisely what it would be, I don't know right at this point.
You know, I guess when I read the statute, I'm trying to visualize what was the policy, what were they trying to reach by that terminology. And it was obvious, it appears to me, that in light of what the concept of unemployment is out of work to no fault of their own, that you're looking at the situation where the teacher could have been employed,
yeah,
but because of their own action, they're not employed.
Yes.
and that they're going to deny him for that reason.
I think the original thinking between this, between him was the feeling that apparently persuasive, as far as Congress was concerned, that teachers are not ordinarily, they take the job of teaching with the understanding they're not going to be working during the summertime. And to provide them benefits during the summertime would be to provide them a windfall. I think that was a key stone of the right rationale for this thing. Now, it put all kinds of ramifications and implications. Whether your approach would be a feasible one or not, I don't know, to tell you the truth. If this were not a regular term, or a period between two regular terms, it's quite possible that payment could be made within the description of the federal law. I guess we haven't thought that through, to tell you the truth.
Very true, but I doubt if it would have come up if we had not this year had school districts that closed in the state, and the possibilities were that they were going to remain closed. Representative Otto.
Mr. Chairman, I have a question that relates to unemployment and not concerning school districts. Maybe you want to pursue school districts before I ask my question?
I'm sorry.
I have a question relating to unemployment, but it doesn't concern school districts. Okay. Maybe you'd want to wait and...
I would. My intent is that I know there are people from the agriculture community are here, and I would like to try to close up the questions on education by at least 10 till 10, so that I could give those people a chance, because I know they have a number of concerns themselves about the recent changes. Representative Rogers. So we'll just wait until then. Okay.
If we define term in some manner, such as from the starting date in the fall to the ending date in the spring of the school term that includes at least 190 instructional days or whatever we might could use, and that's a pretty fast question because it might create other problems for us, but then that would resolve this problem. That sort of thing would resolve this problem, would it not?
If it were a realistic definition, I would think perhaps it would. Again, I'm guessing, and it may not purpose anything I have to say, but all I'm offering is my own opinion.
I understand. I'm glad that you're sitting where you're at, and I'm sitting where I'm at.
Unfortunately, your opinion has been somewhat in concurrence with what our employment division has told us earlier. I still don't believe them.
I would submit that the employment division is one of the most outstanding units that we've encountered in the country. We have the pleasure of working with them.
And get to the day.
Yeah. Now, two other questions, just briefly, that I want to answer after the teachers. Is there anything in the federal statutes or regulations that would prohibit a teacher from drawing unemployment insurance up to the historic period of employment if their contract is reduced? Example, the teacher was on a 220-day contract, and that contract was reduced by the school board to 180 days. Would they be eligible to draw unemployment during the 40 days that they had been historically employed? In other words, they had always, let's say, for 10 years worked on for 220 days, and that's the way the contract was paid. But the school board reduces that 40 days to 180. Is there anything in the federal law that will prohibit them from drawing unemployment for those 40 days that they had been historically employed before?
Yes, sir. It's that period, sir, within between terms, as we've been discussing.
They would be caught in the general statement that you've been talking about, between the successive terms.
Right.
And, okay. Another question. Is there anything in the federal regulations or statutes that would prohibit a teacher... Well, let me go back one. What a situation we're having here is that a teacher signed contracts for 12 months, but the contracts are not paid in 12 monthly installments all the time. Many times, the contracts generally run from September to September. And what happens in June, the school district pays out the total contract. So if there's nothing received in June, July, and August, is there anything in the federal regulations that would prohibit the teacher from drawing unemployment during that period of time if they had no reasonable assurance that they were going to be employed again in September?
Nothing under the federal law, no.
Okay.
whether or not the individual is assault with that kind of a 12-month contract would be considered unemployed within the meaning of that term in the state law. I don't know. That's a matter for state interpretation.
Okay. Another question about substitute teachers. This has come up here in testimony as to whether substitutes are required to be covered by unemployment compensation under the recent federal enactment. Will they be required to be compensated if they meet all the other requirements of the unemployment compensation law?
In extending coverage to virtually all state and local government employees with certain exceptions, Congress extended coverage to substitute teachers, in our opinion. They're not among the list of exceptions, the accepted categories.
So they are required to be covered?
Yes, sir. And again, of course, they must meet, this is not always true of substitutes, they must meet the qualifying requirements in the state law in order to be eligible for benefits. The same requirements that apply to other workers. They would be subject to the between terms and now also.
Another one is to. Oh, okay, that's a different subject. The next thing I would like, the last question I have of you is, have you seen what we sent, how the 2131 that we sent?
It's
if you would grab one of those 2131 and turn to page 4, and line 25, starting at line 25, that's section 3, the language in italics there is being deleted, is proposed to be deleted from the statute. And I guess that I'm going to ask you if you have read that, because I would like to know if there's any requirement that that be deleted out of the statute.
Yes, sir, I would urge that it be deleted.
Why is that?
If I understand the language correctly, it provides for denial of benefits during recess periods, whether or not they fall between school terms.
Okay.
And this would, I think, violate the between terms denial and the equal treatment requirement.
Okay. One last. I just thought of another one that we had asked you about before. One of the problems we're having with community colleges is that on page 3 of that bill, that under the present definition, that an institution of higher education, specifically by statute, includes, if you'll note the italics again on page 18 through 20, lines 18 through 20, it had expressly stated that community colleges were institutions of higher education. It has been suggested that we could resolve the problem that Representative Wilhelms was talking about concerning the classified employees, the non-instructional staff of community colleges, by stating that community colleges are not institutions of higher education and, in fact, are educational institutions under that definition, because that would take them out under page 5, lines 22 through 25, where it says benefits-based and services firm rather than an instructional research or research capacity for an educational institution other than an institution of higher ed. Could we, in fact, and I guess I know the answer to this, but I just want you to say it back. Can we, in fact, say they're not institutions of higher education if they meet the statutory requirements of institutions of higher education? In other words, we're saying they meet all the requirements of the definition, but we don't want them considered that. Can we do that?
I think by saying they're not doesn't make them not.
That's what I want you to say. Okay. On that question, I'd like to bring in right now, if I could, because Don Shelton from the community colleges, this has been his concern all along. And Mr. Shelton, would you want to come up and ask Mr. Murray the question, Mr. Rubin, the question that you want?
Thank you very much for the opportunity. My name is Don Shelton, Community College Assembly. Mr. Rubin, looking again at section 3, line, in terms of the criteria for the definition of an institution of higher education, these are four all-inclusive standards, if I understand it. Am I correct in that assumption?
Yes.
The community college in line 9 through, pardon me, 9 and 10 does not meet the definition in part. Oregon law ORS 341505 charges community college to admit people with a high school graduation, their equivalent, or the ability to profit from instruction. Community colleges have a high percent of students, maybe attending full time, who do not meet this criteria. Community colleges in election law are defined as a school district. There are a number of definitions throughout different sections of statutes relative to community colleges. But there is some particular arrangement. And in this particular one, we are charged by law to admit students who do not meet that definition and do so admit a great number of them. The question is, then, is such an exclusion, since we do not meet all four criteria, a possible exclusion?
In other words, you're not asking whether they would be excluded from college, you're just asking whether they would be excluded as institutions of higher education.
From this definition of institutions of higher education, yeah. And thus eligible to be considered as an educational institution under other criteria of the law.
Is this again important in some sense? The criteria spelled out on page 3 of an institution of higher education looks very close. It's probably identical with the corresponding criteria in section 3304F of the Federal Unemployment Tax Act. Absent one of those, then my understanding would be that the community college could be exempt from being considered an institution of higher education, and if it does not admit eligible students, only individuals having a certificate of graduation from high school or the equivalent. And it would not meet all criteria. We would encourage, I don't know why you would seek that kind of exemption.
We have a number of employees that food service and so forth who are sought the job because it only offered 9 months employment primarily because their own children were school and this gave them the opportunity to be off during vacation period. As such, they are not really very eager to enter the labor market because they sought such a job.
Mm-hmm.
In essence, it's a collective bargaining extension of about $880 per year for such employees, where they really sought it on terms by which it would have this vacation period.
Well, I guess I'm confused because the thing is now, the between terms now, the required coverage applies not only to colleges and institutions of higher education, but also to the public schools, primary and secondary schools, and public and private schools.
Oh, you're saying there's no difference between an institution of higher education and an elementary secondary school?
There are some differences, yes, but not significant ones, and I would not think that there would be a particular benefit.
You're saying then that the denial of benefits between terms could exist for institutions of higher education?
The denial of benefits between terms? Yeah. I think you've included one of the gaps. You're talking about non-professionals,
yes,
working for colleges or universities. You're quite right, I'm sorry. The requirement does not apply to that one category, that is non-professionals employed by colleges and universities. I understand now why you're thinking.
So, in essence, then, they could be, since they do not meet that criteria, excluded.
That would be my guess.
Appreciate the opportunity.
Mr. Murray, we're about to
Rubin.
Mr. Rubin.
Okay.
I'm sorry, Mr. Rubin. I shouldn't do that.
I have to see you okay.
Mr. Rubin, we're getting close to the hour that we want the agriculture people to get a chance to talk to you. There's just one other area that I've been requested to inquire of you about, and it's this area of legislative employees. And the question that we have is there anything in the federal law that would prohibit the state from requiring as a condition of employment that an employee sign a statement when he comes to work for the legislature that he would not, in fact, file claims under the unemployment insurance laws of the state?
I think there would be both a state law and a federal law prohibition against that.
The legislative employees are going to be covered regardless of what they sign or anything else that they do.
Yes, sir.
Okay. Is that okay,
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead, Representative Starr.
To get back to that example that we were talking about on the blackboard, and you said that on account of the between terms that it was a problem that we would have a little difficulty solving.
Yeah, that was my answer.
Yeah, and Representative Kinnegossi brought up that we have a proposed amendment that would consider this problem as a budget failure and a difference in the way it was looked at. The U.S. Highway Department says that's a no-no. If we enacted that into our law, into our statute, because I think the majority of us, or probably all the people on the committee, think it would be altogether proper, who would be what to who?
Are you asking what the sanctions are for Germany? Could I ask you indulgence for kind of a long-winded reply?
No, I don't want to take up too much of your time.
Okay. The Social Security Act in 1935 set up unemployment insurance as a federal-state program. It provided, this way, it provided a tax offset device. The Social Security Act levies an employment tax on all employers, and it defines employers. Originally, it was only eight or more in 28, but it hired eight or more people, but now it's one or more at any time. Now, your tax rate, the current tax rate, is 3.4%, and come January 1, 1978, it'll be on a $6,000 wage base. Now, technically, every employer in the state and the country is liable for the 3.4% federal tax, federal unemployment tax, the payroll tax. However, the Social Security Act went on to say that if an employer pays taxes under an approved state unemployment compensation program, then the employer may receive credit against that federal tax. Not everything. He can't receive 100% credit. He's still liable to the federal government for a certain percentage. And originally it was 90%. The original tax was 3%. The 90% of 3% remained 2.7. Mm-hmm. He could receive a credit of originally up to 2.7% against the federal tax. This is still true. But that's conditioned upon the state having an approved unemployment compensation law.
Oh.
Now, the conditions for approval are spelled out not only now in the Social Security Act, but also in that part of the Internal Revenue Code that's called the Federal Unemployment Tax Act. So, in addition to that, each state, from that residue, that amount the employer still pays to the federal government, come the funds back to the state to pay the cost of administration. Now, if an employer is subject to the federal law, but not to the state law, he's covered under the federal law, but not the state law, he's liable to the federal government for the full 3.4%, and he gets no offset credit against for taxes he paid the state. So what I'm suggesting is that if the state is in violation, if the state neglects, for example, to cover a category of state or local government workers, or it does not cover nonprofit organizations, these are requirements for tax offset credit for any employer in the country, or in the state, rather. That would mean then the result would be that the employer would not get the tax offset credit. He would then be liable to the federal government for 3.4% on a $6,000 base. If the program were to continue in the state, he would be liable also to the state for whatever the state tax is. I understand the average rate is about 3% now in Oregon on an $8,000 base. But he'd be liable for a 6.4% rate. That rate would be prohibitive.
Mm-hmm.
So the denial of tax offset credit is one of the sanctions. The other sanction, if the state is not eligible for tax offset credit, neither is it eligible for administrative grants. So if the cost of administration were to be financed, the state would have to provide a source other than the federal grant. Those are very formidable sanctions.
Yeah, I didn't quite follow all that, but I get the point, and it answers my question.
One other question on the example over here that we want to get straight, because we have you here. I gave you the situation. The closure actually occurred at the end of the term. So a whole term of unemployment. And that was the easy part of the question. What would happen if, in fact, the school district closed on November 1? Now, from what you told me, since that is not between terms, but in the middle of the term, that they would be eligible at this particular point. My question is, would they be eligible from November 1 until June? Or would they, in fact, only be eligible from November 1 to January 1 when the new term would start? And then that would be the period of disqualification.
My understanding would be the latter. They would be eligible only to the beginning of the new term.
Thank you. like now to turn our attention to House Bill 20-132, and it's the agriculture labor provisions that have been changed. And I know that there are a number of people from the agriculture community here, as I said before, and I would like to have the questions addressed by them. The one, Mr. Gentleman, that I, as myself, am most concerned about is on page 2 of that bill, line 8 through 10. And we're trying to figure out just who the federal government was trying to include, because we have a form of agriculture here in the valley in which, such as berries or pears or just a variety of different fruit commodities, that we're afraid that you're going to pick up an awful lot of our people who may only employ people for, 3 weeks or a month, and are going to meet that $20,000 gross payroll. And one of the things that you probably are aware of, that we've been in a fight out here about the 12-year and under exemption for picking berries. And we're just in a position that the people want to know if, in fact, that that's going to prohibit them from hiring the kids because of the fact that they're going to have to pay unemployment compensation on them.
I can only speak, I don't know very much I can tell us about agriculture, and the criteria, the definition of agricultural labor is taken from FICA, the Social Security part of the part that relating to labor. We've adopted that pretty much. The criteria covers.
Why did they pick that definition? I don't see the relationship between that and why it should be under unemployment compensation.
I don't know the answer. I don't know why there should be a difference between a definition of agricultural labor for, on the one hand, Social Security purposes, and on the other hand, unemployment insurance purposes.
Okay.
I don't know enough about the distinctions or the subtleties of the definition. So.
Well, you say that if the people in the agriculture community wanted to know how that's going to be interpreted, that they have a precedent already established and they should look under the FICA?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. That certainly would be my first suggestion.
Okay. Go right ahead.
The criteria, at first, as I recall, the administration bill back in 1975 recommended extension of coverage to agricultural workers employed on a farm employing, I think, 4 or more workers in 20 weeks. It would have extended it to small farms. The final, after negotiation and considerable discussion, this compromise was reached to extend coverage to the larger farms, as indicated by the criteria.
Does the panel have any questions they would like to start asking Mr. Rubin at this time under that bill? Because if not, I'm going to open it up to the people from the farm community to come up and ask their questions, and just at one at a time if they have a concern. Dave, if you would want to sort of somewhat centralize the questions to Mr. Rubin that you have, please feel free to come on up and get a further clarification of it.
Ms. Turner, we appreciate the opportunity to visit with Mr. Rubin and the committee.
Please identify yourself.
I'm Dave Nelson. I'm representing today the Oregon Water Resources Congress et al., I guess. But in bringing the agricultural community under unemployment compensation, there's a number of questions. One, first from the irrigation districts. I don't know if you're familiar with irrigation districts as entities. They are organizations put together by farmers to bring water to their farms to irrigate with. Owned and operated by the farmers, and though they did go to the state for the statutory authority to collect the irrigation assessment and to organize under a system. Under the existing law, they've been considered quasi municipal corporations and not, in fact, really governmental units, but I suppose under current law, considered governmental units. The proposal, or the won through a number of court cases here in Oregon an exemption since they were considered agricultural labor, and under our current statute, considered agricultural labor. the federal law, as I understand, says any instrumentalities of the state shall be covered. Now, an irrigation district as an instrumentality of the state, on the one hand, could be covered under that provision, yet being agricultural labor, could the state provide that they be excluded if they fell below those agricultural limits?
If the
irrigation
district is considered either an instrumentality of the state or a political subdivision of the state, any employment would be covered regardless of the agricultural nature of it. It would be subsumed to a political subdivision, and there is no exclusion in terms of the type of work that's performed for a political subdivision that must be covered, even if it's agricultural work, it would have to be covered.
Regardless of any state definition of being agricultural labor.
Yes, sir. There's no exemption. It's not among the exemptions permitted to otherwise required coverage of services performed for a political subdivision or instrumentality of the state. That's my understanding.
Okay, interesting.
I think that I back up a little bit. The definition of political subdivision is, I guess we've taken the position whatever the particular state is either incorporated in the state constitution or the state statute, we would accept what the definition is for the political subdivision. So we're not about to prescribe in one definition of the applicable to every state.
Perhaps a whole. under the definition of 10 employees in a 20-week period, our the current bill says that 10 employees on a day in 20 different weeks. Now, do you interpret that as being very specific? So if an employer had 9 employees each day of a week for 20 consecutive weeks, that wouldn't be average to, or wouldn't be cumulative to be over the 9, or would that be?
I'm not sure. This is no different, though, from coverage in the unemployment compensation before 1970, which extended only to employers. This is the whole private sector entirely, of employers of 4 workers in 20 weeks. I've forgotten how they were, precise language released, but it doesn't require that there be 4 full-time workers for all 20 weeks.
It's on a man-days or man kind of an arrangement. So if a farmer had 4 people on Tuesday and 5 on Wednesday, that would be his 10 for that week?
That would be my understanding,
yes. And
consequently... Yeah, Mr. Nelson, yes, sir, and that, I'm sorry.
But even the word, I'll tell you.
I will get the answer, though, for that. I'd be happy to.
Here's the...
Mr. Chen,
Daddy.
You said 20 weeks. Did you mean 20 days? That's what the language in this.
Well, as I read it, Mr. Chairman, Representative Rogers, 20 days, then the phrase in there, the clause saying each day being in a different calendar week.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay.
So that's why I spread it over that 20-week period. So that would allow perhaps some more leeway than what the 20 days might. Mr. Rubin, is the state at any liberty, or does the state have any liberty of setting for the agricultural community a new, perhaps lower new entry rate into the system for, rather than coming in at the maximum rate?
You mean the tax rate?
Yes.
I think there would be a problem if agricultural employees were set apart from the normal process, the normal experience rating structure that applies to other employees.
By a problem, you mean federal
level? I think there would be a conformity issue, yes.
Is there, just congestionally, is there any the agricultural community, as I've talked to them, don't see or don't make an issue of coverage of permanent or relatively permanent full-time employees. And the issue is generally those who are working during the summer harvest period, where those people would, by all rights, or generally nearly 100%, not be eligible for benefits, yet they would be paying the tax rate on them. Is there any way that you could see to, for the state, since understanding what the federal government's done, or the Congress has done, is there a way to separate by state statute the payment of taxes on part-time as opposed to full-time employees?
I think that would create a problem, a conformity problem too, Mr. Nelson. You would be then assigning an agricultural employer a rate based on a different basis than a rate assigned to his counterpart in private industry, by distinguishing from that rate a special category of workers.
So then the strawberry grower who has a 3-week employment season and the kid's now 12 and over, go out and pick strawberries for that 3-week period, he'll pay the full tax rate on those kids who will conceivably work maybe 8 weeks during the summer. They'll not have any eligibility for benefits, yet he'll be required to pay the full rate on those children during the summer.
He'll be subject to contributions on the basis of employment performed by those people. Of course, those experience in work, if these people either do not or cannot file their claims for unemployment compensation, this would mean that in future years, when his rate pays expense for unemployment is measured, he qualifies for a lower rate. So it would turn out that way.
Mm-hmm. Well, Mr. Chairman, I think that pretty well concludes my questions. There may be more from anyone.
Yeah. Other persons are welcome to come and ask Mr. Rubin questions.
Yes, that's a really good question.
Yes,
do I understand you to say that a berry grower would have to pay unemployment insurance into the fund on seasonal people working for him, like the strawberry pickers and all?
Yes, sir. If he comes under the criteria, that is, the 10 workers in 20 weeks, or a payroll of $20,000 in a quarter, then he would be liable for taxes on the basis of that payroll, and if that payroll included temporary workers, if that payroll included seasonal workers, it would be part of it. Yes, sir.
Even though it's conceivable that these seasonal workers would not be drawing unemployment insurance.
Yes, sir.
Could I ask one
question?
Yes. What criteria do you have listed here in the bill, in line 6? Is that a requirement of the federal law?
Let me back up a little bit. When I spoke of the requirements in terms of the loss of tax credit for employers in the state, I was speaking to the required coverage of political subdivision, employment performance for political subdivisions for the state and for non-profit organizations. And failure to do that would result in denial of tax credits for all employers. This is not true with other categories of employment, including farmers. For example, suppose that Oregon saw fit not to cover farmers employing 10 or more workers, but rather 20 workers. We're not on a payroll of $20,000 a quarter, but a payroll of $50,000. Really, only those really huge farms. What would happen then would be that since this criteria applies under federal law, that employer would be liable to the federal government, that single employer, not every employer in the state, would be liable to the federal government for the difference between 10 and 20 in one case and 20 and 50 in the other case. In other words, he would not get credit for that portion that was covered by federal law but not by state law. That would be the only sanction that would apply there. The state would be certified for tax credit law, another employee could not be affected. But that particular employee would be liable for the difference between what was subject to federal law and not subject to the state law.
Okay, so
or not. My question was, is this requirement of the federal law?
It's not a requirement.
It would be a lot easier if we put this language in. I mean, it would be in exact compliance then with the federal law.
Either this language or extend it broader.
Now, let's take the extreme example in the other direction. We choose in this committee not to pass this bill out. And we keep it right here, and no bill passes here in this case. Then we're going to be out of compliance with the federal law.
Yes,
sir. All right. What effect?
Not until January 1978.
Right. What effect will that have? Well, let me see. I understand from what you said just previously that there will be no effect of our action in doing that on other employees in the state.
But yes, you're only talking about the agricultural coverage.
Yes, I'm talking about buying.
732 in more particularly.
Right. Our inaction on the bill would not affect other employees in the state in any way.
That's correct,
but it would affect, well, our inaction, I guess, wouldn't affect the agricultural employees, but the federal law then would affect those same employees that we're talking about in this bill.
Yes, sir. Come January 1978, that'd be subject under the federal law to federal things.
Okay, so either way, they're going to get hit, and the result would be then that there would be no unemployment benefit for these workers if we didn't pass the state law.
That's correct. There would be no unemployment benefits, but the employer would still be liable to the federal government for the full federal tax.
That's what I'm getting at. So the employer would be paying the tax, and nobody would get any benefits.
That's correct.
If we don't pass the bill.
Yes, sir.
If we do pass the bill, then the employers are going to get hit with the tax, and employees would be, if they met the criteria.
The employers will be hit with the tax, but not the full federal tax. The tax ultimately will be determined by whatever the employer's rate will be as comes about from the operation of the experience rating provision. I should add, too, that during an initial period, I guess about the first 6 months of 1978, there will be federal reimbursement to the state for the cost of coverage for these newly covered categories.
That might be a way, Representative Wilhelm, of enhancing our experience rating. By not paying any benefits. I
haven't finished this. Which I probably wasn't paying as close of attention as I should have been when you were answering Representative Starr's question. I was trying to, but frankly, you got past me there.
That was unintentional.
So if they didn't pass the bill and they were subject to federal tax and they weren't subject to state tax, which way do they get hit the hardest? They get hit the hardest by the federal tax. Is that right?
My guess would be, yes.
Because there would be no offset.
Right.
You saying no?
Because the total is going to be the same. As long as the state does not levy any tax, it's going to be this amount. If the state levies a tax, the total comes to the same amount. Am I right, Lee? Or did I word that badly?
Lee Russell, Assistant Supervisor, Employment Division.
It depends on what happens to House Bill 2128, to what a new employer will pay. New employer under House Bill 2128 will pay an wagon tax of 3.5%, but he would receive on his 3.4 federal tax, he'd receive a 2.7 offset. So in effect, it'd be a total tax of 4.3%. Is it 17? 4.2% compared to 3.4. So it's a full federal tax.
Right. So if we didn't require him to pay a state tax, pick someone and say we don't require him, the federal still charge, it'll actually cost him less.
Well, if House Bill 2128 is enacted, if it isn't, then it would be about the same because 2.7 is the current rate for new employees.
Okay. Well, if they're not new employers. Of course, these would all be considered new employers for the period of time until they qualified as old employers.
If they qualified as old employers, eventually it could cost them more on the federal rate because the minimum in Oregon can be below 2.7. I mean, if the fund got built up to the extent that had a minimum rate of 1.2 and because if in fact no benefits could be paid to these individuals because they could never have a valid claim, and that particular employee would be entitled to a minimum rate of 1.2, he'd be in effect paying a 1.9 rate combined state and federal tax instead of the 3.4, which is the full federal.
And we're in a position on this bill to vote aye and bring agricultural communities into the working and into the unemployment compensation structure and charge them a tax, or to vote no and not bring them in and charge them more of the tax than they would be if they voted aye to bring them in. It seems to me that if we pass this bill, they're going to be better off tax-wise in the long run than they would be if they did with no dividend.
The particular employer might be that the tax money that would be paid by the employer would be going back to the internal revenue. There'd be no benefits to the Oregon employer. So to the Oregon economy, I don't know what the net effect would be. If the amount of unemployment benefits that are paid to these unemployed workers exceeds the difference in the tax, then the Oregon economy would be losing.
Well, I haven't got far enough, frankly, for you to figure out what effect it's going to have on the economy. I just kind of figure out what
effect it's going to have. I would judge that the agricultural worker, on the average, would draw about an equal amount in benefits as they paid out in taxes to the state. I mean, if the seasonal industry pattern prevails in agriculture.
Can I ask Lee a question that maybe Mr. Rubin could respond to? Then you would not expect any significant experience adjustment, Lee, and over time you would expect it to be about a cash in, cash out situation, other than perhaps a surcharge?
We don't have any experience in Oregon. All we can look at is some studies that have been made in other states. I think about 19 other states that were agricultural surveys conducted to determine what the effect on the overall tax structure in those states would be with the coverage of agricultural workers. And most states, and of course it was based on sampling, no actual conditions, it indicated that the amount paid out in benefits would slightly exceed the amount of taxation in those particular states. Now, they were looking at the tax structure in those states at the time. Oregon's tax structure is a little higher than average in the state, so I would judge that the income and the outgo would be about the same, and the average tax paid by the average ag employer would probably approximate somewhere between 3 to 3.5%, probably closer to 3.5%.
Employment tax is a tax deductible, I think, for income tax purposes by employees.
I'm assuming for cost of doing business, and it is deductible as business income.
Well,
I'm
going to ask you. I don't have any trouble with the term of individual disability, but I really don't understand completely the 20-day requirement, and I was wondering if you could elaborate a little bit on that.
Let's assume you have an employer who hires 10 individuals every Monday for 20 weeks. That individual has 10 or more individuals in on each of 20 days, each of those days being in a different week. Now, from so he would be subject. If you had 10 employees for 19 weeks, or if you had 50 employees on every Monday for 19 weeks, and that was all he had, never met the $20,000 in a calendar quarter, he would not be subject. Couldn't. Now, that says if you have 10 or more employees on each of 20 days, each of those days being in a different calendar week, it doesn't have to be every day of the week, just one day of the week.
So if you had 10 employees for
20
days, you
wouldn't
have any
delay. No, it would only be 10 or 9 in 3 different weeks. 4 if there's 10 of them. If you had 10 of them, except one, and one had 9, and technically, in the class.
if you don't have it for 19, it's 21 and 19 W-8.
Yeah.
So as long as you pay out $20,000, you're caught anyway.
If you pay out $20,000, you're down the quarter, you're caught.
Regardless of the number of employees.
Representative Rogers.
I don't know what transpired while I was out plotting, but this concept of taxing without any subsequent benefits because of being non-compliant, has this been in the court?
Yes, it is. It's been in the court. First case of time that was in 1937 or 39 or something like that.
By the federal government because the state is not in compliance, but yet no benefits are paid. Because as I understand it, that is what happened.
That's correct. But that's the way it's supposed to be, Mr. Edwards. The federal law provides for a payroll tax of 3.4%. And it provides also that employers in the state can get credit against that federal tax if they pay it and then approve federal employment compensation and the Secretary certifies. And after that certification, then the employer will be liable for the credit tax for all time. What they would have to do is if they neglect to cover certain payrolls. If they neglect to cover large claims, then what would happen would be that the federal payroll tax is extended. The others can go to 178 for large claims. The state doesn't cover them. And of course, that letting payroll doesn't get covered against the federal tax. He says that if they're not covered under the state law, then the employees can go no benefit.
And this has not been challenged in recent years?
Yes, sir. The validity of the tax asset approach has been pretty well
established. I think it's time.
You do, sir?
I'm not being interested in a case that's pending before the Supreme Court right now in Chicago. Reduced and discriminatory practices in the police department, and they're dealing with borrowing $19 million a quarter. And I think the Supreme Court, at least the Court of Appeals, has said that the police department had to comply.
What's that? I mean, what?
So if you don't comply on your money. So.
No, I mean, talking about this particular thing.
And
have
the same concept
to find. I'd like to elaborate a little bit, Mr. Rogers, what you consider the background of that provision. Prior to the Social Security Act and this requirement in it, only one state had an unemployment insurance law, that was Wisconsin, and even Wisconsin hadn't paid benefits under it. Following the enactment of the Social Security Act, including this feature of unemployment insurance, at least that you think they're doing anything you say so.
Well, I have one question, but I don't know about what maybe it could be handled later on, I believe. I'd like to have your comment on. Somewhere along the line, either Congress or your agency has had to think about the problems involved with administering the tax on agricultural employers who have the typical harvest that you're talking about, either strawberry farm or the potato farm or the pear farm or whatever it is, that goes out and recruits bodies to come in and harvest that crop. And it really bothers me a great deal as to how we're ever going to administer this tax on these employees. How that employer is ever going to administer that tax within his operation because of the nature of the way he recruits the people. There must have been some conversation about this somewhere along the line.
There is considerable discussion, you've got to recall, but consider too that some states have had it from Puerto Rico that covered agriculture workers, Hawaii covers agriculture workers. 2 years ago, California extended coverage to agriculture workers. We don't know if it's very famous. But I would prefer the minister of the to address the community, so you got to keep the handle of the administrative things as issues. But I suggest we're not without experience in it.
Well, I wonder if we're not without experience, if some of the situations that do occur in the state. I don't know how, I think it would be a physical impossibility to administer it in some of the places that I've personally been involved in. And taking the bus down on 3rd and Burnside in Portland, and recruiting day trippers to go out for a day, and paying them at the end of the day, and that's the way the crops get harvested in some cases. And I just don't know how in the devil we're ever going to be able to administer that. And of course, I realize it's not your problem, and I'll ask you some questions.
I don't know what that's going to do. I might comment on that as far as administering the tax. If the employer has a record of a gross payroll, without all the individual names and so forth, we can assess the tax on the payroll. If those individuals' names and so forth are needed for claims purposes, that's where the problem will probably arise. I mean, if the employer is going to use those wages as an offset deduction on his income tax purposes, it's pretty obvious we can see what the wages, growth wages are. The matter of getting the detail necessary for paying the unemployment, that will be another problem.
Maybe that's what I would do.
That's where the problem is.
Yeah.
If the client has no Social Security number in their name, nothing to identify a particular individual, they will have difficulty. I don't know what the problem is.
People that work for me at any one time, and under this, possibly nobody will come under this. Now they go to another person, another person. The paperwork's going to be astronomical with agriculture under this.
They will anticipate that. That's how they impact it.
Well,
dollars to be paid into the program, and very few of those dollars would be collected in employment benefits. In other words, we're putting in the nature of agricultural unemployment. We'd be putting the dollars into the program, and a very small percentage would be taken out of the other benefits.
Basically, the students in the States, I think for every dollar that goes in the program in the family taxes, there'd be a dollar go out in benefits. And there may be a high proportion of the individuals that do not qualify for benefits. For instance, the cannabis industry is a good example. Approximately 70% of the individuals that receive wages from the cannabis industry do not have the necessary 18 weeks to go for $700. But yet, the amount of benefits paid to former employees of the foreign ministry is equal to or in excess of the amount of taxes paid by that group. So even though only less than a third of the individuals actually would have a valid claim for benefits, that one third draws sufficient amount of benefits to offset the taxes.
So, maybe a quick question may be that you do have a different experience and it does get better. What's the minimum amount that a firm employers can work as right down to it?
1.2% is the minimum that's possible under the Oregon law, and that's quite a few years down the road. We probably won't be in Schedule 1 of the tax rate table at least 8 to 10 years, if even then, and it's not really designed unless you have several extremely low unemployment years where the funding would get built up, so you better achieve Schedule 1. Generally, you'd try to remain somewhat in the middle range of the schedule so you have just an adequate fund. And there's the minimum rate, I don't have the law in front of me, is somewhere around 1.8%.
When you talk about experience in other states now, Puerto Rico has been mentioned in Florida, has been mentioned in California, and they suggest, and presumably none of us, that is the agricultural employment is not exactly maybe call it career, but it's more of a year-round situation, which there isn't in Oregon. And so we're just looking at two altogether different things, isn't it, Alan?
California has a longer growing season than most of Oregon and Hawaii and Puerto Rico. There will be differences. We don't know what differences there will be, what similarities there will be.
We've got another kind of companion to other 2132 that it's kind of likely to take care of a transition period to the supplement of 2132. That's correctly.
Yes. The House Bill 2134 will provide immediate benefits to the newly covered workers after January 1, 1978, based on wages earned prior to that date, and the federal government will pay that portion of the cost.
That's far enough. It's just an implementing procedure, and if you get the problem running out in 2132 and 2134, no problem. Is that fair statement?
That's right. Mm-hmm. Okay. Picking up the wages prior to January 1, 1978 would be no different than we do now on the Supplemental Unemployment Assistance Program. We'd have to be requesting that information from the employers so that we could include it on a claim determination. This would all be paid by.
Suppose somebody starts out in California in the spring and in January and puts together a raise and they say, you're not or any particular period of time. They go over 18 weeks and they end up going from Arizona to California to Oregon. And at the end of 18 weeks or 20 weeks, they end up in Oregon and then they work further away.
Are they eligible for benefits then?
If they had,
depending on which state they're claiming benefits against.
I mean, if they're claiming against Oregon, but the claim against Oregon, the individual would have to have 18 weeks in federal employment in Oregon, and California, the combined rate in the various states for a valid claim.
You can't.
Yes.
So if somebody, if it's a transitional claim and moves from one state to another, they accrue the 18 weeks. And then when they end up in Oregon,
for
15 separate occasions when an issue has been raised to the level of a conformity hearing. But denial protects offset credit and denial for administrative grants cannot be done on an arbitrary basis. It requires first that when the Secretary has reason to believe that the state is out of conformity, he's required by law to issue notice to the government and to the state agency and to offer an opportunity for a hearing. This is a hearing before an administrative law judge. And by the judge, then it is a recommended decision that the Secretary either accepts or not. In 1970, the determination by the Secretary is subject to judicial review. It's a long process. And as I say, it's happened over the 40 years, and probably now about 16 times, which I think is it's suggestive of the kind of close cooperation that they put forward on permanent and present board cooperation between the federal and the state agencies. Especially the state government would suggest that there are maybe 35,000 employees over the country in unemployment compensation. The federal part of that is 150 back in Washington, John Reagan offices another 120 or so. The rest is all state.
The 18th Amendment, the 21st Amendment, changed the the description of the period to both the state and the federal period, the national period, that is to say, when any time in the nation as a whole reaches a certain point, it triggers every state now. And it's been a benefit in between the period and the period. It's a fairly minor change. And to,
I've been here.
I think we touched on it, and it's a real problem, and the way it is that the employment security agency is
House Labor Committee, Tape 10, Side 2, Wednesday, March 16th, Public Hearing, SB 310, 56, 311, and 422.
Presently interprets the language of ORS 659415, which states a reinstatement right for an injured worker to a former position that is available and suitable, if they can perform, to intend that this would include the same or similar positions which the employee is qualified. At present, the employer could argue, and we've had situations where employers have argued this, that former position is narrowly intended as the exact position. So that a job at machine number 3 doing the same work is not the former position, although this is the same work as an available and suitable position at machine number 4. Proposed change from the language former position to the same or a similar would avoid the arguability of the present language. The Bureau of Labor has read the legislative intent of the 1973 Act to be that persons not lose their livelihood because of industrial accidents, presumably involuntary to them, but at the same time that no bumping right be applied when the job has been refilled. This language would therefore clarify the intent by obviating technical defenses on whether the available and suitable work for the exact former position. We also believe that the new wording provides greater flexibility to the employer when an injured worker seeks reemployment, in addition to expediting the return of an injured worker to the productive workforce. The second change in the bill was an amendment suggested by the Senate Labor Committee. Can be legitimately termed a housekeeping matter, as it merely rephrases existing language in a positive form rather than a negative form.
Any questions? Representative Reba.
Is this a real problem for you?
Well, so far, we've been supported. And our attorneys believe that our present interpretation to interpret the same or similar job is correct. We haven't been successfully sued on this, no.
So you haven't had any great...
No, we're just trying to clarify the language so that when we send out our information on brochures to employers, we can cite the statute and explain exactly what we mean when we talk about rehiring requirements. It's more to clarify the language and bring the language in line with our current interpretation of the legislative intent of 1973. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Any further
questions? Thank you, Mr. Wolf. Mr. Bob Kennedy?
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, committee members. I'm Bob Kennedy, president of the Oregon AFL-CIO. Speaking on behalf of Bill 310, I would be repetitive in my arguments in support because Mr. Wolf has already made the case. I might state that some of the things that he has referred to as a former business representative, this is true about the situation where somebody got the nitpicking about wanting his job back on one certain machine, when really that was only just nitpicking. And so we do also support it because of the fact that sometimes an employer would just change the job to a very minor degree to eliminate having to take this person back. Really, the AFL-CIO would urge to do pass recommendation on Senate Bill 310.
Any questions, Mr. Kennedy? Mr. Rogers.
Bob, you said that there were occasions that did those that you know of get resolved favorably? What was the final outcome?
Well, it was. We had on those problems that I had, some of them. He always just held tough to his position that the law said that this, you know, I get my old job, and that's what he wanted. And really, when it really made no difference, that they accepted just the case of nitpicking.
Mm-hmm.
And however, on the other side of the coin, well, there's been times when we did lose because there had been a change in the job, and it was not exactly the same. It was similar, but it was not exactly the same. Person couldn't easily do that job, but they've done some small duty added to it, so it would be preeminent.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chairman,
yes.
I wonder if I could go back to John Wolf for a second.
Mr. Wolf, would you come up here, please?
In your, I just wanted to have you make clear, which you may have already done, in one, two, three, the fourth paragraph, but at the same time that, I better read the whole thing, the Bureau of Labor has read the legislative intent of the 1973 Act to be that persons not lose their livelihood because of industrial actions presumably involuntary to them. Okay, but at the same time that no bumping right be applied when the job has been refilled. I think I know what you're talking about there, but I
Okay.
Would like to.
It's the employer's discretion, really, under the current law, and that would not change at this time. The employer may hire someone on a temporary basis to fill the job, and I must indicate that 415 pertains to accidents or injuries which are not so serious that the person could not return to the exact position. 659-420 deals with the more serious accidents. I want to make that distinction first. Mm-hmm. But the employer has the discretion as to whether or not he or she wants to put a temporary employee in and then let that person go when the injured worker is, has been released to return to work.
That's bumped by the original holder of the position when it works again.
If the employer makes that arrangement, to just put in a temporary person. We, the Civil Rights Division, the Bureau of Labor, does not require an employer to bump anyone off the job to rehire an injured worker. That's why we talk about the language is worded that the worker would be rehired for an available position, an open position. We don't require an employer to bump anyone.
Okay.
Mr. Wolf, do you think that is the statutory intent of the present statute?
Yeah.
Do you have a copy of the statute with you?
No, I do not. Not the entire statute.
I seem to recall this 1973. And as I'm looking at the statute, it says a workman who has sustained a compensable injury shall be reinstated by his employer to his former position of employment. Then it says or.
Right.
Okay, so I want to read that in the disjunctive and don't read the rest after the or, but read it where it says to his former position of employment upon demand for such reinstatement, provided that the workman is not disabled from performing the duties of such position.
Right.
A certificate by a duly licensed physician that the physician approves the workman's return to his regular employment shall be prima facie evidence that the workman is able to perform such duties. Now, as I recall, that statute in 73 had two parts to it. One was to require that the workman, if he is injured, and he is capable of performing his former position, that he be reinstated to that position. The second part of the statute, as I understood it, was the fact that if the workman was not able to perform his former job, that if the employer had an available position, he would give it to him. And that's why, and what you've just told me is you've interpreted the first part of the statute the same as you had the last part. That he doesn't get his former job back if he's able to perform it unless there's an available position for him.
Correct.
And I don't think that, as I recall, was the intent of the statute.
Well, certainly the way we have interpreted the statute, and
well, the statute would then be a nullity. I don't know if you're telling me that if the position went available, why even have it on the books? Why not just have the guy go back and reapply to the employer for a position?
I'm not certain I see your point.
My point is that the statute was originally enacted, to my understanding, to require an employer to hire back an employee who was injured on the job and can perform that job.
Correct. And still protect the rights of other workers.
If you look at the last part, there's another statute that your bill doesn't talk to. But there's another statute at the bottom at 659-420. And it's talking basically about the situation in which a workman is not capable of performing his former position. And that states at the bottom to that section is a totally different section. It says such right of reemployment, whenever talking about the new position, shall be subject to the provisions of seniority rights and other employment restrictions contained in a valid collective bargaining agreement between the employer and a representative of his employees. It appears to me that the legislature expressly put the concern that you expressed about employment rights in the situation when he cannot perform his former job, but it did not put it into the statute as it relates to his getting his old job back, his identical position. And you're telling me that's how you're reading it.
We're reading it because of the phrase which is available, or employment which is available under the current statute. And our intent was to make that more clear by using the same or a similar position. I think our interpretation of the present statute is correct based on the wording of the 73 Act. Now,
Mr. Wolf, I'm going to make a suggestion to you, and I would ask you to do it before the meeting. You mentioned this bill set up for the next work session. I'd like you to go back to the archives and look up this bill, and if you would look at the original version of this bill that was originally introduced,
And if you're wondering why I'm excited about it, I was the one that introduced it. And I have an idea of what we were intending, and Mr. Fredericks understands this provision very well because we got it hung up in about the last 2 days of the session where it was going back and forth. Now, if the committee wants to take a different approach to it, that's fine. What I'm concerned about, I don't think you're interpreting the statutes the way the people intended to be interpreted. Would you go look at the history of it and find that out in the archives for me? Because I think if you look at the statute, it was a rather rigid and rather harsh statute because it provided a cause of action, in fact, if the employer didn't hire him back. And that was part of the negotiations where it was all modified and amended. But I guess the thing is that I feel very strongly about this provision.
And my question then, just as a, assuming I were an outsider looking at this, is to question what the phrase or employment which is available is doing in that statute. Just as an outsider, I would wonder what that's there for.
It's because it was to take into consideration of the situation, in fact, where the guy, where the physician would not issue him a medical certificate that he was capable of performing his former job. That's what we're concerned about.
We could put him in the fourth through all that.
That's right.
Okay, well,
thank you.
I couldn't have seen a conflict.
This could then work against us. You probably wasn't popular in the trial. Who had to go over the position?
Sort of. Representative Wilhelm's memory of seeing God.
I think it's a big employer where you've got all kinds of positions. You've got clerical workers and you've got, you know, machine operators and so on. It can appear to me where you might cause some problem with the word the same or similar position. You know, I don't know what's similar to it. If a person is operating a Caterpillar tractor, and is disabled to the point where he can't, it seems to me like maybe there would be an issue over whether or not if they wanted to stick him in the office and let him handle the payroll, that they might not have to do that because it's not the same or similar position under the new language, whereas under the old language it says, or employment which is available and suitable, and if it was available and suitable, they'd have to take him back, and I don't really think most employers object to that, and I don't think most employees do. But it seems to me like it might not be able to happen under the new language.
That's a 4-2-0 situation where a worker is injured in such a way that even when he's released to go back to work, the injury has been such that he cannot return to even the exact position. He cannot be a bulldozer operator for whatever reason or whatever the nature of the injury is. In which case, that worker then comes under 4-2-0 rather than 4-1-5. It only applies to injuries. Probably not very serious injuries, serious enough to be out of work for a while, maybe a broken leg or arm or a laceration or something like that. But when the worker has been released by the physician, that worker could return to the exact physician if it were available.
That's kind
of odd. I'm trying to understand what you have said and what Mr. Wolf has said. In his testimony here, I have to use a little bit of example. If we got the job at machine 3, which his man had been handling, and the job at machine 4 might require a lesser level of expertise, that would certainly be similar if it was a machinist position, but that if it pays less, that would still be a similar position, and he would not be entitled to his old job back because that had been refilled. You say that no bumping rights would be applied when the job had been refilled.
Would not require an employer to bump.
And so this injured employee who returns to work could be then required to accept a job that actually pays less than his old job just because it was similar.
In practice, what has occurred is that employees, the workers, say that exactly machine number 3 was taken, and he didn't get back into that job at that time. Some employees have taken jobs at pay rates less than, that's basically on their own volition. If the position is available, the pay is comparable, the benefits are comparable,
then we would encourage the employer to hire that person back for that position if it's available.
But if he's under 415, man is physically capable of performing the job that he was doing before. No question about it. He is physically capable. He goes back, he's released from the doctor's care with this certificate, and I say, sorry, Charlie, we've hired another guy to run that machine. Now, we've got this other machine over here that pays $1 an hour less, and so you can have that one. What you're telling me is that's what the guy stuck with. And what the chairman has told me is that was not the intent.
The employer, when a position would open, say, whatever position it was, machine number 3 and machine number 4, that was the same ideal position, or comparable.
Similar,
right. The employer is required to take that injured worker back as soon as that position becomes available. He wants to put the injured worker in a similar position with the other machine until another opening occurs on the old position.
The chairman says that was not the intent of the legislation. The intent, according to him, was that he was entitled to his old job back. Is that correct?
Well, the policy was a policy decision, as I understand it, and what we were trying to foster, that if a workman was working and he was injured on the job, that he would have his job back if he was able to perform that position. And what was happening in working with all employers, because I know that there are many employers who probably make an effort to get the guy back to work. But what happens is that we wanted to have it as a policy that if the man could perform the job, that he'd get his job back. And that's why the statute was put in. But the way it's being interpreted, I think it is doing exactly the opposite of that. Because what you're doing is, one, you're telling him, even if we take you back, because they can always argue that the position isn't available. But then, if in fact, if they do take him back, they can put him in any place that they want, at a lower pay, or whatever type position he's in. And I think that is contrary to the policy that the legislature was trying to get at in 73. I still think it's a valid public policy to have the employees rehire the people after they're injured. And that's why the doctor's report was in there, to show that the person is physically capable of performing the job again. My appearance of it being decided is I think that you're interpreting it differently than what was intended.
Well, as a practice, what employers have been required to do is to take, if the position is not open, even under current language, it says, or employment which is available and suitable upon demand, to rehire the worker at that time, or rehire the worker when the next opening occurs.
John, let me ask you a question. Because how many complaints have you had filed under 415 or 420? Do you estimate?
Probably about 15% of our complaints are under that section.
How many complaints has the Labor Commissioner ever issued against an employer, an order against the employer, in violation of this section?
I cannot answer at this time. I can check.
Would you check with me? Because I think you're going to find out it's probably none.
Well, orders only arise after hearing.
That's what I mean.
Generally, these cases are resolved. Almost all our cases are resolved before they ever go to hearing.
Would you check with that and see what the disposition of them are? And I would like to know if the employee was ever hired.
Mm-hmm. That's a question. John, in your department's experience, what occurs most frequently in an employer and employee relationship, that the employer can assign the employee to a particular position, a job, or is it more or less prevalent that the employees of a given employer would appear on a seniority list, that they can use that seniority to exercise a displacement on a job? In other words, what I'm getting at is suppose a person was injured and it came back 6 months later, and his seniority or his tenure with the company would maybe allow him to, in that period, have been promoted or been able to bid on a higher and better job. And I'm just wondering about that employee's right if we go to similar language, it just bothers me to be heck that he doesn't have a right of displacement. And I just wondered, which is most common in...
I think I'll have to check the case file to answer that question.
I understand what I'm trying to get at, but first my experience has been in the railroad industry where it's just strictly seniority, and if you come back after 6 months or a year, where you're just looking through what jobs are available and say, that's where I want to go, there's no questions asked. And maybe it would be a lesser job because of the seniority, but, you know, the availability of the I just don't know how extensive the other
I would have to look at the case file.
Okay.
John, let me ask you one more question. Has the Bureau of Labor, the Labor Commission, have promulgated any administrative rules as regards this section?
Not that I'm aware of.
Has there been an attempt to do that?
Well, I know that when I was working as a civil rights investigator, there were guidelines produced for us for age and physical handicap. I think at that time that those were internal things to aid the investigator in terms of handling a case rather than formal rules.
Thank you. Any further questions?
No.
Thank you, John. If no one else signed up on Central 3 test, we're going to set this over for another hearing, and I guess I just would like the record to reflect exactly what our intent is going to be, and if it be any guidance to the Labor Commission for any interpretation of the statute that they can help the legislature effectuate what I think the intent, or I should say what the committee thinks the intent was. Next bill, Senate Bill 56.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Seth Gill, and I manage the State Action Insurance Fund. Senate Bill 56 is a simple housekeeping bill, in a sense. Deals with volunteer personnel in municipalities. There are certain requirements for coverage of volunteer personnel by the city. It requires them sending in a list of names of all of the volunteer personnel they wish to provide coverage for. And if a claim occurs, it's only accepted on the basis that that name is on the list. As with a lot of businesses, cities have a turnover of personnel, also volunteer personnel. That changes from day to day almost. In order to have them properly covered, it requires them to continue to keep that list updated with it. Unfortunately, sometimes that gets sidetracked and the list doesn't get in, an accident occurs, and there is no coverage. This simplifies the method by which they can cover their volunteer personnel by just listing the number of people they wish covered and to pay premiums on that basis instead of listing the name. It does require them to keep an official roster at their locality. I don't believe that there is any opposition to this bill. It will resolve a lot of problems as far as paperwork and certainly the worst problem of all of someone getting injured and not being covered. I think that's the gist of the bill. I'd be glad to respond to any questions.
What are some examples of volunteers that would routinely be covered under?
Primarily, most of them are in the fire and the police area. A lot of small towns have volunteer firemen to assist their regular fire department on call in case of some large fire that can't be contained by their local firemen. So you'll find towns that will ring the bell and all the volunteers will come running.
The most common,
there are a lot of them that substitute police that come and work on a volunteer basis, work a shift, work a night shift a couple times a week. The law specifically indicates some here as a fireman and policeman, ambulance driver, rescue boat operators, deputy sheriff, those types of activities, usually to respond to emergency situations, but they have them trained when the emergency comes up.
And as a volunteer, not so much in the case of volunteer firemen or policemen, but as a volunteer on some emergency or whatever the case might be, they would be covered under the workers' compensation laws, and
they will if they elect to cover, if the city elects to cover. Yes. Not automatically, the city has to make that election. The volunteer personnel under the law is considered non-subject workmen, so because they don't receive any remuneration, so in order for anybody to cover them, there has to be an election to cover those volunteers.
And how do they establish premium?
They establish an assumed wage, and they pay premium on an assumed wage for the life activity that might take place.
So a volunteer rescue boat operator, for example, could be injured and receive benefits.
Yes.
Is there any cases on the books like that?
Oh, yes. There's a number of volunteers, but they have paid premium on them, just like any other normal workman. The alternative to that, of course, if they aren't covered, there is the city or the other is certainly
liable
or could be.
Yeah.
Chester, does this fancy apply to anybody other, I mean, does it apply to school districts, let me?
Not really. There are some sections this specifically says that, well, it does say the county, city, or other municipality employing, so it doesn't apply necessarily to school districts, although there are some sections in the law that do apply to the school district.
I have an amendment that I want to get in for school districts, and I just don't know if this is the vehicle that I'm going
to... I think there is another bill coming up dealing with volunteers probably before this.
I'm concerned about the cooperative education program that when schools hire students, and I'm more concerned right now about what happens when the students go out with the participating employers. I think the situation has arisen with the rates, and I've heard it at Johnson City where my kids go to school. It has a very strong cooperative education program. And we now have employers who are not wanting to hire the students because of the fact that the workers' compensation rate is so high. And I know you have a special provision for the school districts, and I want to work in that, but if this isn't a vehicle, I'm not going to...
No, this isn't a vehicle, and I think we do have one.
Okay, thank you. Okay.
Now, this 031 starts out, I think, seems to me pretty specific about who is covered. Because it names them, and so I would assume that under this statute you would have to stay within those named people.
Yes.
So it definitely would not cover staves or anything of that nature.
That's correct.
Okay. Now, what does, in the terms of this statute, what does municipality mean?
I suppose municipality is generally termed all cities, but it has a broader connotation, I believe, in the incorporated area, I suppose, in a governmental body.
So that would cover a rural fire protection district, would you?
Yes, it would.
Under this term.
Yes.
Don't recall a municipality ever being used quite in that context before.
I can't say for sure, but I believe I looked that up some time ago, and it does cover, and we do cover, a rural fire district that are formed and are under that statute.
Mm-hmm. Now, what in a situation there are times where a rural fire department might have some kind of an emergency, and passers-by would get involved in helping.
Mm-hmm.
Would those people be covered? If one of those people was injured in a situation like that, would he be covered since he is not going to be on a roster of any kind?
There is another provision in the law that requires for emergency or allows for emergency volunteer help. And it allows them to operate in much the same fashion. They can elect to utilize that kind of help if they so wish. The only restriction is that it has to be someone who is not that intimately involved in the fire, that it's their house.
Yeah.
People don't use very much sense in that situation. So apart from that requirement, they can enlist emergency volunteer help if they want to apply for that.
And so that...
And they would be covered.
That would be the discretion, at the discretion of the unit?
Yes, it would be. And they have to be enlisted by the man in charge of the fire at the time or in charge of the disaster.
Okay. So... And it could be an after-the-fact thing?
Yes.
Okay. All right, now what do you talk about an assumed rate of pay?
Mm-hmm.
What is that assumed rate of pay?
The assumed rate is usually the wage or the rate that's normally paid in that particular area for what?
Okay, so
or for the bonus.
So if there's a, the only person in this fire department is that's paid is the chief, would that be the measure?
No, it would not. It would normally be paid if you just have one person, the chief, that obviously is receiving a salary that would be much greater than that of the fireman himself. There are a lot of guides to establish what that rate of pay is for similar localities.
We don't pay our chief very much. Okay, thank you.
What's in the bottle?
Two questions following up on Representative Rogers. What happens, and I think this is true in some fire districts, that they pay a flat fee for every time the firemen are called out, $5 a call or something like that. Would that be the same rate of pay then?
No, there is obviously a rate of pay that would not generate a proper assumed, and assumed wage is also applied there for the exposure to make sure that they generate enough premium to cover the cost of the exposure.
All right, then one other question. In the case of a fireman, well, let's say it's a fireman. Full-time firemen are not spending all of their time fighting fires.
Yes.
Now, part-time volunteer firemen are only subject to fight fires on call. How do you determine the rate? Do you say a fire takes X number of hours to put out, or are we also including the training sessions? Just what all are we including?
We include the total exposure of the firemen, and certainly don't limit it to just the time you get the fire. And the premium represents the total exposure of that fireman's duty. The time that he's off duty and not exposed to the high hazard, and also the time that he is exposed to the high hazard.
When he's off duty and not exposed, okay.
Well, yes, it's just
if you're on call, say, 24 hours.
That's right. You anticipate the rate will be much lower if he's not exposed a great deal. So the rate reflects how much claims are paid out in the total fire classification, total fireman classification. And so we can relate that to just by the dollar input and the dollar output. If he spends a great deal of time in an area where there's no fires and very little exposure, that will be reflected both in the rate and the experience rating of the municipality or the fire district.
Representative
Bob. I've got a little trouble relating the sub 1 at line 529 to the first line in the summary. Does that say what that first line in the summary says, or does it say just the first line in the summary says this exact opposite? I'm in a little trouble. I'm looking at the words other than those, and shall not be considered, and then the word unless, and there's too many conditions there. I haven't. It just looks like that first line of the summary is misleading, but I could be wrong.
Yeah, part-time employment, is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, uh-huh.
Yeah, that is misleading. That really has no continuity at all. It was put in there by our underwriting division to clarify that there are a lot of volunteers that only work part-time. I don't think there was that question before.
Okay.